from the number one sports site in the world.
Yahoo!
This is Yahoo Sports Radio.
YahooSportsRadio.com.
Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Yelovich is an own goal! It's an own goal!
With your host, Joe Mago. From Yahoo Sports and Yahoo Sports Radio.
It's right! It's a landslide!
Joe Mago and all the insiders from the FC Yahoo Soccer Blog bring you coverage of soccer across the world.
Premier League,
MLS,
Champions League,
La Liga,
Serie A,
and Bundesliga. It's all the coverage from soccer across the world.
This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Oh, it's good in!
Right now. From the Yahoo Sports headquarters in Playa Vista, California, here's your host, Joe Mago.
Hello and welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Mago, editor of the FC Yahoo blog on Yahoo Sports. And joining me on this episode here in the Playa Vista podcasting room in Los Angeles are Alex Baker, to my right.
Hi, Joe. Nice to be here.
To my left, Shahan Ahmed.
Some would say I'm the number two pick in the draft.
That was a Lakers reference, by the way, for those who don't follow basketball. And on Skype, all the way from New York, is Leander Charlakens.
Like my countryman Louis van Gaal, I'm happy to still be employed every single day.
All right. We are recording this show a couple of hours after the Europa League final between Liverpool and Sevilla. It was a tale of two halves as Liverpool took a 1-0 halftime lead on Daniel Sturridge's 35th-minute goal and then watched Sevilla come back with 3 second-half goals for a 3-1 win and a third straight Europa League title. Liverpool was unlucky to not receive at least one penalty in the first half as a number of penalty shouts went uncalled. Guys, let's start with what really undid Liverpool in this game. What played the bigger factor, the missed penalty calls in the first half or a rampant Sevilla in the second half?
I'll start with rampant Sevilla in the second half. I mean, after all those missed calls, Liverpool was 1-0 up at halftime. All they have to do is play out 45 minutes, play to the same level they played in the first half, and, you know, they probably get a couple of those calls. They should have scored even... You know, in spite of not getting those penalties, they probably could have been up 2 or 3 goals. They completely outplayed Sevilla in that first half. And then Sevilla came to life in the second half, really. They had one shot in the first half, finished with 11 for the game. That's astounding. It was night and day, really. But, I mean, yes, there's plenty to talk about, and we're going to talk about it. But that Sevilla came out in the second half. They did their job.
Throw it to you, Leander.
It's rare that both teams have a Jekyll and Hyde performance within the same game. And Liverpool obviously had a great first half and then a terrible second one, and Sevilla had the opposite. The only difference is that I think Liverpool put away 1 of 4 clear-cut chances, give or take, and Sevilla scored 3 of their 5. Obviously, Liverpool had very bad luck with, you know, there were 5 plausible penalties that they could have gotten. There was that... the handball in the box, which happened 4 times. And then there was that weird foul on James Milner in the box that really, if anywhere else on the field, it's a foul, it's probably a foul in the penalty box as well. And it should have been a penalty. And that's bad luck. But if you set that aside and you tell teams to control the things that they can control, you know, if they put away another chance in the first half, that game is over, even with Liverpool's defensive deficiencies, which came to the fore in the second half. I mean, they have themselves to blame for this more so than the ref, I think.
Yeah, Liverpool definitely could feel hard done by the calls, but I think it's hard to deny that over the course of the game, Sevilla was the better team overall and are deserving winners in spite of the missed penalties and what have you. But Liverpool had a great chance. They looked really good after the goal. They could have gone on. They could have added more. They didn't do it. They came out in the second half. They seemed still to be in the locker room, and Sevilla, you know, got on the board and pretty much took over the second half. So
yeah, Liverpool looked good in the first half. Sevilla looked better than Liverpool looked in the first half and the second half.
Exactly.
And that's why, if on the balance of it, I think you would say that Sevilla played better over 90 minutes, even though, like Leander said, neither team necessarily put together 90 full minutes. But that second half, I mean, Sevilla, there we came out like gangbusters, especially in the face of the way they played in that first half. That was impressive. I don't know what that halftime talk was, but they need to bottle that up and use that every single time they're down at half.
It was pretty apparent, I think, also, guys, that Sevilla had played in finals before and had played in a lot of them, you know, winning this three times in a row. And Liverpool, I can't think of a lot of players on that roster that have played in these major, major games like this. Yeah, you can say it's only the Europa League, but nevertheless, it's a European final. And that was pretty apparent because Liverpool, they give up that goal 15, 16, 17 seconds, whatever it was, after halftime, and they just panicked. You know, Sevilla almost scored again, and then eventually they arrested the momentum and then control, and then they got their goals. You know, you could also say, as Shahan alluded to, that the halftime adjustments made by Unai Emery for Sevilla really, you know, worked a lot better than whatever Jurgen Klopp did, because they, in the second half, just figured out a way to play through that Liverpool counterpress, which is not an easy thing to do. And I think that underscores how Sevilla, which is such an adaptable team, even though their players come and go so fast every single year, have such a strong record in this tournament and are a team that's so good at playing in these two-leg elimination tournaments, because they can make adjustments and they can sort of play in different ways. And that's how they can rescue a game like they did on Wednesday.
This isn't a reason why Liverpool went flat or lost, but I thought this tweet was interesting. The second half stats of Philippe Coutinho: zero shots on target, zero chances created, zero take-ons, zero crosses. So maybe a little bit of what you're talking about, Leander, guys not being in that moment before, having to, you know, deal with adversity in the moment. Maybe that was a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the only one. Firmino didn't look right all game. He didn't really do much of anything, and he's the one who got the hook.
Disappeared. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're talking about Sevilla making those wonderful halftime adjustments. This is the fifth straight final that Jurgen Klopp has lost, which, I mean, it bears mentioning at this point. It's you know, five in a row. That's kind of, and you know, you look back and you can say, okay, he lost the Capital One Cup, whatever. That's not a cup that really matters. You can say he lost, you know, the German Cup before he left. The first in that line was actually German Cup to Bayern. So you chalk that up to Bayern. Lost the Champions League final to Bayern. You say again, okay, it's Bayern. The third one, the last game he actually coached for Dortmund, they went to the final and they lost to Wolfsburg when it was supposed to be his send-off and this wonderful thing after they had actually eliminated Bayern in the semifinals and gotten over that hurdle, and then they kind of went flat against Wolfsburg in that game too. So, yeah, there is a bit of a trend developing, and I don't think you'd entirely put it all on Klopp by any means, because Leander's right. These players, you know, they should be completely different come next year. But there's definitely something brewing over there that needs to be overcome.
Well, Klopp did take the fall after the game. He said he took full responsibility for the loss. He said afterward, "In this moment, I am responsible for this performance. There is no criticism, and I have spoken to my players. Nobody in the stadium believed. I thought we could change it, but it was not enough." And as far as him not winning a cup final, he was pretty philosophical about it. He said, "There are more important things than football. I have a lot of luck in my life. I will be in another final." He didn't say I was going to win another final. He said I will be in another final.
Yeah, you know, in defense of Wolfsburg, that season, that they actually came in second in the Bundesliga, and Dortmund came in seventh. And I don't even really think, I know a lot of the English media made out that Liverpool were huge favorites in this game, but I didn't see them as favorites. So I think he's been in some maybe tougher finals than we're making out, the Bayern ones aside. Sevilla are obviously very good at this tournament, know how to win it. And I think that we're getting maybe evidence that the team that finished seventh in La Liga is a bit better than the team that finishes, what did Liverpool finish, 7th or 8th in the season?
Premier League? Yeah, I think it was 8th or 9th, actually.
Yeah, so they're about the same in the table, but I just think it's sort of evidence is that Spanish football is superior.
Sevilla didn't win a single home or away La Liga game. So, you know, okay, this is neutral ground, but we're not talking about anywhere near the top team when you actually look at Spain. They're Europa League specialists, sure, and they proved it today again. You know, three in a row is not by accident, and that, you know, there's kind of that, I call it the Sevilla rule because it didn't exist until last year where you get that automatic entry into the Champions League, and it was because Sevilla kept winning the Europa League that they're like, yeah, maybe we should let them in. And, you know, there is a giant windfall that comes from that. I wrote about this, you know, kind of entering into it, and it's an extra
nice plug.
Yeah, it's an extra €12 million participation fee, and then you get an extra million for every match you win in the group stages of the Champions League on top of, you know, the €6.5 million that you get just for winning the actual match itself. So last year, if Sevilla, this whole progression to come back to this Champions League final all started by winning that final last year, and if you actually add it up, it's over $50 million that they've collected in addition to what they would have gotten if they just lost last year's final.
Well, let's get into what is the secret to Sevilla's success? You know, they have an amazing coach in Unai Emery who makes the most of what he has. They have an exceptional a director of football who really works miracles. And, you know, really buying low and developing talent and then selling high, the director of football, Monchi. So, but really, what has been the key ingredients to this recipe?
I think that Sevilla figured out that there's a lot of waste in the upper echelon of soccer. And Sid Lowe had a great column about this in The Guardian the other day, sort of talking to Monchi, and he told him, I think he, at any given time, he has a short list of like 250 players that he's looking at, and kind of depending on what his coach needs exactly, that gives him a breakdown of a half dozen guys for every single position or role that they might need to fill that they're sort of constantly updating. And they kind of figured out that, you know, when you're, let's be honest, I mean, even with three straight Europa League titles, a second-tier team, you know, you're not Atletico or Real Madrid or Barcelona or one of the big, big clubs, but you're just below that. You know, there's a lot of players you can get that just are good players, but that just aren't quite good enough to break into the starting lineup at those bigger clubs that might be sick of sitting on the bench and that you can get on a discount because they want to leave. And so they've really perfected that, I think, to pick up the guys that, you know, like Kevin Gamero, who just kind of fell by the wayside at Paris Saint-Germain when they started buying all those big guys. There's a lot of examples like that. Guys they got on the cheap because they kind of bombed elsewhere, but that are still good players. Guys that they got on freeze because they waited out until their contracts were up. They're just really, really savvy in the transfer market. And granted, that's by necessity more than design, I think, because they're a club that has struggled financially for a very long time. But there definitely is a plan behind it. And it's you know, it's the sort of thing that maybe should be taught in business schools.
Well, and yeah, add to that a coach who's known to be a workaholic, who makes his players watch videotape after videotape and studied the opposition. So I think, you know, we've seen it with Klopp at Dortmund and with Simeone that a really excellent coach can take a group of players and make them sort of better than the individual parts might suggest.
Yeah, I will just add, you know, to back on what Leander said, Fernando Llorente is a player that they brought in this year. It didn't quite work out, but that's kind of the same thought process where it's like, oh, you know, this guy has proven in the past that he can play. He's a good player. We can get him on the cheap. Yeah, let's bring him in. You know, this is actually, I think I'm correct in saying their fifth Europa League in the last decade.
Which is 11 years.
11 years, okay. So that just goes to show you that it's not just this three-peat that they've been doing. They've been competing, and they take this competition seriously where, you know, English clubs, Italian clubs, other clubs don't necessarily see this as something they can win. I think Sevilla doesn't have any illusions of the fact that they're not about to win the Champions League. They look at the Europa League as, hey, this is a competition. It has history. We respect it, and we're going to try and go out and win it. And, you know, to their credit, they do.
I want to go rogue here for a second and throw out a curveball at you guys. Going back to Liverpool for a second, how much credit does Brendan Rodgers deserve for this run to the final?
Whew, that's a tough one. I mean, he did, you know, the Welsh Messi, or no, Welsh Pirlo, Joe Allen, was on the squad.
Saying, how much credit do you give Andre Villas-Boas for buying the players that Mauricio Pochettino was able to finally get them to play, guys like Eric Lamela? I don't know if there's a...
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think that when a new manager comes in, he should get the credit for what he does. Just like, I don't think that you would give Mourinho any credit for what Goose was able to do in terms of getting them back to stability this season. And then, you know, same for when Roberto Martinez took over and he takes them to Champions League final. I don't think you take that away from the manager who actually accomplishes the feat. So I don't think that Brendan Rodgers really plays into this. I think that it was... I think, yes, he started with this squad and he, you know, went through a good amount of the season with them. But really, once Klopp came in, it's been a different aura, a different feel, different style. And going forward, I think that when they got past Manchester United, that had nothing to do with Rodgers. That had to do with Klopp.
Yeah, I agree with you. But at the same time, does that mean... what Barcelona has done since Pep Guardiola left has nothing to do with him?
No, but I think that it's changed. I think you don't take that away from what Luis Enrique did. I think you give Luis Enrique the credit that he deserves for the job that he did. And, you know, he didn't just start off and everything was just wonderful. He definitely had some turmoil. He almost got sacked before they actually pulled it all together. So I think that you just can't. There's always going to be some overlap between managers and players because, you know, it's never really that clean of a break. But when a new manager comes in, I think you got to give him credit for getting the squad behind him, rallying him and rallying them, and then taking them to whatever they do achieve, even if it is losing in the final. I don't think you take that away from Klopp and put that on Rodgers.
Yeah, I don't think they'd have got past Borussia Dortmund with Brendan Rodgers in charge. I just don't really see that, and I can't really equate what Brendan Rodgers did at Liverpool to what Guardiola did at Barcelona. I see your point, Leander, but I do think you've got to give Klopp credit where it's due.
I see where Leander's getting at is you know, laying the groundwork for a team to play like play like Sevilla has done. To fulfill, you know, its potential. I go back to Nigel Pearson for Leicester, the back end of what they survived, the relegation battle. There's some momentum coming. Well, you wrote about it. It was really, yeah. Robert Huth.
Yeah, I mean, he was the catalyst for me. But, you know, it goes back to the same thing. So do you give that Decima title to Mourinho, even though Ancelotti's the one who won it? Because those players were pretty much the same. I mean... I think that there has to be a schism, and the break that you have to do is with the new manager coming in, unfortunately. Yeah, of course, these players develop under multiple managers. Every manager they serve under deserves a bit of credit for their development. You don't take that away from them, but when they actually win the trophies, the guy who guided them in the final, you got to give him credit, or the guy who got them to the final, you got to give him the credit he deserves.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm trying to get at. I mean, it's that... You know, this is something where maybe Rodgers' legacy is going to look a little bit better in hindsight now that this has sort of happened. But I think it also speaks to the placebo effect that managers tend to have, where sometimes they don't need someone who's doing things radically differently. What they need is just a new face. I mean, there's Eric Winalda who you know, is trying very hard to be a coach. He likes to say this, that a manager's job is to keep the players happy and healthy. And sometimes what that entails more than anything is just being a fresh face and just, you know, to be a manager that the players are not sick of. I think there's an enormous amount to be said for that. And you kind of saw that with Klopp, where there's still Rodgers's they're still his players. They're, you know, the formation is not enormously different. You know, Klopp came up with the press and everything, but and you saw the same thing with Hiddink at Chelsea, where they turned around. I mean, sometimes I think we overstate a little bit the impact of a manager beyond just getting along with his players and getting them to get along with each other.
Well, now that the season is over for Liverpool, Klopp will finally be able to begin his rebuild and bring in his own players. Where do you guys think are the areas where Liverpool needs the biggest upgrade?
Left back.
Well, that was easy.
Alvaro Moreno had a nightmare today, and you know he's. I think actually that whole back line they probably need to re-examine and kind of see where. I mean, Colatore at this age and at this time probably isn't a guy that you want to be starting in a cup final. I know he's experienced and all, but and they've been hit by some injuries. But really, it just comes down to you have to have a better center back, and you know the windfall of money coming to the Premier League teams. They're going to be able to go out and just outbid anybody who's not a Premier League team. Even the teams that are just getting promoted now, they can outbid most every team in Europe to bring in new players. So I mean, the quality of players that a club like Liverpool should be able to put together, there should be no questions. I mean, you should have international players that are still playing at an international level on that back line all the way through and through.
It should be noted here, though, that Klopp didn't build his own team at Dortmund and won't probably at Liverpool either. I mean, there's sort of a hierarchy above him that will be doing most of that, although he'll certainly be influential. But as to what Shahan is saying, I'm really interested in if what's going to happen if the English clubs are sort of going to cannibalize each other in the transfer market, where they decide to all go after the same players and then drive up the prices to these ridiculous heights just because they've decided that they all want Mats Hummels or they all want James or they all want whoever, rather than kind of being smart and all going after different players and spreading the wealth a little bit in that regard. I think it's going to be fascinating to see this summer's transfer market.
Yeah, I'll second that, and I don't really need to add much more. I think this is going to be the most interesting summer.
Well, Sevilla goes to Madrid on Sunday to face Barcelona in the Copa del Rey final. I want you guys to assess Sevilla's chances at the Vicente Calderon against Barca.
Yeah, I would love to make an argument to say that I feel like they could win, but I think Barcelona, in the form they've been in, they've just been steamrolling teams. The way they closed out the La Liga season with, you know, 24
goals, 0
and zero conceded in five games. Yeah. You know, Sevilla, they've just, granted, got a Europa League win behind them. That's going to be good for their momentum going into the game. But I just think on their day, Barcelona, whatever little hiccup they had that saw them stumble for a minute and get, let the La Liga race back on and get out of the Champions League, it's clearly over. So I don't know. I don't have any favorites.
Go ahead, Leander.
Then again, this is a final, and I think this goes back to what we were talking about Klopp before. I mean, finals are their own things. I mean, they're not, you know, nothing that happened before matters. They're pass fail, and they're completely unpredictable, and that's maybe why we can't really blame Klopp so much for having lost five in a row, because every time a final happens, it's a sample size of one, and it sort of stands on its own, and it's its own. So, you know, is Barca the favorite? Yeah, but, you know, Sevilla is so good at, under pressure and in knockout-type games. I would only say that I would give Barca maybe a 60% chance.
Yeah, well, I'll just go back to historically. For this season, you know, these two teams met in the UEFA Cup or UEFA Super Cup to start the season. That was a 5-4 game that went to extra time. They met again in Sevilla. That was a game where Sevilla came back and won 2-1. They played the Camp Nou. Barcelona won 2-1. They've been one goal games, all three of them. So I don't necessarily expect a blowout. But to back on what Alex just said, 24-0 over the last five games. Once Barcelona got it together, they really got it together. No one's been able to come close to touch them. No Spanish team anyhow. And, you know, we talked about Sevilla on away from home, we'll put it that way. They haven't necessarily been the greatest team. So I think that, you know, you have to take Barcelona in this one. But, man, if any team can do it, Sevilla is the one. So it should be a game to watch.
Let's take a short timeout. After the break, we'll talk about the weekend and the four other big domestic cup tournament finals, including the FA Cup final, and what could quite possibly be Louis van Gaal's last game as Man United manager. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, direct from the FC Yahoo Soccer blog at yahoosports.com. And if you're looking for a sports radio morning show that is just a little bit more entertaining and has a little bit of fun, along with all your coverage of sports every morning, check out the Steve Zabin Show, direct from Yahoo Sports Radio.
I guess your friend Roseman here, Scott, your people, doesn't keep kosher, huh? Pepperoni and sausage.
I guess not.
Shonda.
My people. A guy whose last name ends in a consonant.
You're allowed to say sausage, right? You just can't eat it. Or is it?
Do what you want, but no, by the rules of kosher, yeah, you're not supposed to eat pork product.
Eat, but you can say the word.
Of course you can.
Oh, okay, good. Just check. If you were to rank your pizza meats,
here we go.
Go ahead and rank them.
Pepperoni, throw me some meats.
Pepperoni, you've got one. Meats,
right.
Canadian bacon.
That's not bad.
Two.
Yeah.
Sausage, three.
Okay.
Hamburger meat, four. No, wait a minute. Barbecue chicken is three. Sausage, hamburger.
Pineapple and ham? Those are okay.
No.
Hawaiian? Steve Zabin. Mornings, 6 a.m. until 10 a.m. Eastern on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Listen live and check out the podcast of the Steve Zabin Show. YahooSportsRadio.com.
It's time to get back to everything. Football and soccer from across the world. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast from Yahoo Sports Radio and Yahoo Sports. Once again, your host, Joe Lago.
Welcome back. I'm Joe Lago, and I'm here with Shahan Ahmed, Alex Baker, and Leander Scharlakens. We are talking soccer. We're going to talk about these four other cup finals on the weekend, or on Saturday, actually. We've got the FA Cup final, the DFB Pokal final between Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, the Coppa Italia final between AC Milan and Juventus, and the Coupe de France final between Marseille and PSG. How about that for my French accent?
Très bien.
But let's start with that FA Cup final between Crystal Palace and Manchester United. That's, of course, being played at Wembley. That is the first game of the day. It's a 12:30 p.m. ET kickoff, and it very well could be the last game at the helm of Man United for Louis van Gaal. So, guys, will an FA Cup title save Louis van Gaal's job?
Probably not, but I mean, I guess there's still a chance he'll stay, so I'll just say probably not for now rather than a hard no. Finishing top four seems to have been the goal, right? That was something where it was like, that was the minimum goal. If you're a Manchester United manager, you should finish there, especially after money you spent since you came in. Plenty of excuses, the injuries you can make. You know, he's brought in young guys. He's actually, you know, he hasn't necessarily harmed the club on a long-term scale, in my opinion. I think that, you know, there have been positive movements, even though people look at Moyes' tenure and compare it to Van Gaal's tenure. I think that he's moved the squad beyond that aging old group that Moyes had, and it is full of fresh young blood. But I think, ultimately, I think that the pressure is just going to probably overwhelm whoever, the decision makers, and they're going to decide, okay, we gave this guy a solid shot, we gave him a couple seasons, and we don't really like everything that we've seen. There have been a lot of times where the football just has looked god-awful, and the results haven't made up for the fact that it looks terrible. So I think that that's ultimately what's going to do him in.
I'm not entirely convinced that this is an Arsene Wenger type proposition where he needs to win this one thing and then everything is okay. I think it depends more on who else can they get. And if they can't get anyone else, are they convinced that Jose Mourinho, who seems to be the heir apparent but has seemed to be that ever since he left Chelsea, if they're convinced that he's a good match for them, and it seems like the club is sort of split down the middle, with one half thinking that they should go with him and the other half thinking that would be a terrible idea. I agree with Shahan that Van Gaal has moved the squad forward. And actually, if you look back at his tenure and even the jobs where he's failed, his second season and his period at Bayern Munich, which he didn't finish, he nevertheless laid the groundwork for Jupp Heynckes. His second spell at Barcelona, which was disastrous, he nevertheless introduced guys like Andres Iniesta. And while it probably doesn't take a genius to realize that a guy like a talent like him should get a shot, he has done good preparatory work. So maybe in that sense, even though he has wasted enormous amounts of money in the transfer market, he may have in a few years from now have had a positive impact. But you know, I don't know that it's going to come down to this final for that reason. If you fire Van Gaal, who's going to be your manager? Clearly, Manchester United right now is a rebuilding job, and Mourinho is not a rebuilding manager. He's a put the final touches on a team type of guy, and I don't know that that's really what they need right now. At the same time, how much longer can you go on with Van Gaal, a guy who's sort of deluded about his performance, who thinks he's doing a good job, and when Manchester United finished fifth, actually goes public and says he thinks United's fans are expecting too much and that they're not realistic, which is absurd, especially in a year when Leicester City wins the title and Tottenham almost comes second. There's a lot of issues there. I don't think that he's going to solve any of them, but I also am not convinced that they know who's going to do it, if not him.
Yeah, United is really stuck, because if they want the quick fix, then you go with Mourinho. But then you also invite all of the other things that come with Mourinho, which is, you know, any number of things. Well, one of them is not, you know, developing the kids, which is what Van Gaal, you know, has done, even though it was out of necessity because he had so many injuries. But and then on the other side, I mean, do you give Van Gaal more time? And do you risk it having seeing more, you know, potentially, you know, drab, dreary, boring soccer where it doesn't seem like there's any point to all of this?
Yeah, I don't think you do. I think if he wins the FA Cup, I still think that he goes, because there's the whole the Van Gaal sideshow. I think people are getting a little bit tired of it, maybe because we always talk about it, I don't know. But you know, he's brought some good young players through, it's true. He finished fifth only on goal differential, so he could have attained the top four very easily, but nonetheless, I think that they're going to look to replace him, and I'm surprised that they haven't.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it, right, going into next season, there's no Liverpool, there's no Chelsea, there's no Manchester United in Champions League next year. So is he entirely off base saying that maybe the fans are expecting too much? Maybe
yes.
Not. Well, Landy will say yes. The fans are always going to expect titles, right? But maybe he's not, in my opinion, entirely off base in the sense that if you spend a bunch of money, which those teams have all done, doesn't guarantee you get to the top four, especially the way the Premier League's set up right now and the way it's going to be going forward. So has it been a good season? I don't think so. I think that it's been marred with injuries. I think that there's been a lot of, you know, soul searching and frankly squad searching. I think Rashford and Martial have really developed, and Rashford just came on the scene and he's in the England provisional squad now. So I don't think it's been a complete disaster this season, but I think that, you know, finishing fifth was below the mark that they wanted him to hit.
I don't really buy the injuries argument. You know, Arsenal had injuries and they still finished in the top four. Spurs for a while had an injury crisis. They finished top four. Liverpool had a bunch of injuries. Everybody has injuries. Everybody has those. Has those periods, and that's just inherent, I think, to being a Premier League team. You're going to play 38 league games. You're going to play a half dozen cup games, if not more. You're going to have a European campaign. You need to be able to deal with that. And I think the fact that United, because of those injuries, didn't have the depth to cover it, and instead had to dip into the youth teams, where Van Gaal maybe got a little bit lucky that a few guys actually did quite well and broke through as viable first team players, that's also his fault that he had to do that, because he had all that money to spend and he didn't spend it well, so he didn't have enough depth in that team. So I don't think he gets credit for performing in spite of those injury crises. I think that he actually should be blamed a little bit for results dipping when they did have all those injuries.
Yeah, I mean, you said Liverpool had injuries. Well, where did Liverpool end up? Way further down the table than United did. You're talking about Arsenal having injuries. Arsenal has one of the deeper squads in the Premier League, and their injuries weren't nearly what United had. United were just completely decimated this season to a point where they had to go to genuinely the most reserve striker that they could find, who just happened to be in the squad just to sit on the bench and get experience on the day. But you know, that's what ended up costing Arsenal a Premier League title that they frankly should have won this year, and they completely blew it. You could blame it on injuries if you want to. I wouldn't. I'd say they just bottled it because that's what Arsenal do. Spurs, I don't think, had injuries to nearly the extent that United did. I don't think it ever got near that point. I mean, when you looked at the spine of all those squads, for the most part, they stayed intact, or they had players that were actually in position. So, yes, I take it that he did not go three deep at every position like possibly he could have considering the amount of money he spent. But the credit that I think you give him is not in spite of the injuries, it's after the injuries. After those players did get healthy, he kept those players that he found, he kept them live.
So what should the United board and Ed Woodward, what should they do? What is the right decision with Louis van Gaal?
I think they should get rid of him. You know, as Sean said, or sorry, as Leander said, yeah, he brought some young players too, but it's not like he had some plan for youth development. He just had a bunch of injuries. He rolled the dice on a couple guys that worked out. You know, an FA Cup's is always good, of course, but I think they need to replace him.
I think that, okay, my answer depends on whether or not those reports that are coming through The Guardian earlier this week are valid and they can actually be backed up, because those reports state that if Van Gaal stays, De Gea is working actively to get out of there. And if you're talking about losing your best player for the last 3 years, that's pretty huge. You know, I think that on the balance, I wouldn't go for Mourinho, because I don't think, you know, the progress you've made with guys like Martial and Rashford, they'd be sitting on the bench and yep. probably out on loan and then sold away, and completely all this growth you had would just be entirely wasted. Look at Lukaku. He's a perfect example for that. You know, and Jose has done that. Okay, you look at Mata, who's been one of their, you know, central squad figures. He's gone as well. Like, all of a sudden, all the progress you did make with this United squad goes completely out the window. So if you have somebody else that's a better fit with a young squad, sure, bring them in. But I think Van Gaal's done well in terms of what I was trying to say earlier is, yes, he had those injuries, but how he reacted after players got healthy was that he rewarded the players that played well when players were injured. So guys like Martial and Rashford stayed in the squad. You know, Rashford in particular, he could have very easily pulled him and taken him off. And when Rooney came back, or frankly, when a host of players came back, he could have found an excuse to put this 18-year-old kid back in the reserves. But he didn't. He realized, hey, this guy played. He can play well. He's scoring goals. I'm not going to just go with the senior squad members, which is what Mourinho would more than likely do, frankly. So I think that that's kind of where, if you have a squad that's developing, I don't think that you necessarily give him the war chest and say go buy whoever you want, especially if he was the one who was doing the buying actively in the last couple of years, because it hasn't seemed to work, the buying strategy overall. So I think that's where I would alter what you were doing if you do keep him on. But yeah, I mean, like I said before, I think that ultimately you can't blame them for getting rid of him, especially because it's Manchester United and the pressure is just too great.
And you've got rumors about guys who don't want to go to United with him in charge. You know, Ibrahimovic said he doesn't want to play at United with Van Gaal. Supposedly Aubameyang doesn't want to go play under Louis Van Gaal. So if the guy's going to become an obstacle to landing the transfer targets that you need, then why keep him?
I think another issue here is, once again, a planning problem for Manchester United. I mean, ever since Ferguson left and sort of some of the guys he worked with, they've had issues landing the players that they really wanted and have had to settle for others, which has kind of had a domino effect onto the problems they're having now. But part of that is not planning for their managerial succession. I mean, Van Gaal is an older guy, for one. He was only really supposed to be a stopgap who would sort of rebuild everything. But there clearly was no succession plan. And now it's May, and the only option they have is Mourinho, and they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, they could have approached Pochettino sooner and sort of realized what he was doing, or they could have gotten in the game for Klopp back in the summer. There's a lot of different things they could have done to better prepare for this, because it's not like this came totally out of nowhere that Van Gaal would have another difficult season. I mean, that was if not predictable, at least a strong possibility. Or you know, start working with Diego Simeone back in last summer and start talking to him and laying the groundwork for that. I mean, the fact that they're now caught in a position where, you know, they really have no good options for a manager is I think more malpractice by Manchester United's board.
Okay, so question for you guys, because, you know, curveball seemed to be the order of the day. Would you give this job to Ryan Giggs or a guy like Gary Neville, somebody who's in-house? But let's say Ryan Giggs, just to keep it simple, because he knows the squad. He's been an assistant for a couple managers now, and he played with United, obviously, for a couple decades. Do you give it to him over Mourinho? What do you guys think?
I probably would, mostly because I think that team needs a fresh face. And I think he's liked within the team, and I don't know that he would necessarily do all that much worse than Van Gaal. He's probably learned a lot being on the sideways. He played for Ferguson for all of those years. He sort of understands the virtues of stability and continuity. And I have the impression, and this is pretty well known about Van Gaal, that part of the reason he likes to play with young players is because they don't give him so much lip. Because he's such a difficult person, and because he's so prone to getting into little power struggles with his players, they just get sick of him after a few years. That's why he didn't last very long at Barcelona. That's why he didn't last very long at Bayern Munich. You know, I think the team is ready for someone fresh. And rather than have another really antagonistic and big personality like Mourinho, I think you're better off with someone like Giggs, who can maybe be more of a Zinedine Zidane and you know, build some bridges within the team and at least get them all a little bit happier again like they were before.
Yeah, I agree with Leander. I was going to bring up the Zidane comparison as well. But, you know, with Van Gaal, you've had so much sort of conflict and toxicity in the atmosphere. And bringing in Mourinho is not going to dissipate that. It's only eventually going to heighten that. So bringing in a guy like Giggs, who's a Manchester United club man, it could come with a feel-good factor. And as we were saying earlier, sometimes that's enough to improve things on itself. And obviously he's got a good football brain. He's got some good experience as an assistant. And there's no one else really out there who's like an exciting candidate. I mean, you heard for a while that Laurent Blanc was in the frame, but that's just sort of because there's no one else. So I think actually Giggs would not be a bad appointment at this point.
I'd be more apt to give Giggs a shot, mostly because what Leander was talking about is keeping some level of continuity of the success that they have had with these young guys. I wouldn't want to put that at risk with bringing on a Mourinho, who, as Shahan said, will completely blow that up and bring in his own guys and probably loan out these promising prospects. But it's interesting how Giggs has never really been. You know, I remember asking our former colleague, Martin Rogers, a while back, you know, why isn't Giggs ever being considered as a successor to Sir Alex? And it was just until, you know, recently where he was actually, when he retired and he sat next to, you know, took that spot next to the manager, was it really, you can really see that Giggs could possibly be that guy.
Yeah.
But he wasn't, you know, it was back in those days, it was Roy Keane was the vocal one. He was the leader. And Ryan Giggs, I think, could be, you know, he can give that fresh face, but also he's a link to the past. You know, he can lead in a manner that would probably work well with today's players, I think.
Yeah, well, one thing I'll just add for Van Gaal, as much as is being made about his temperament with his players, you know, I don't think his players necessarily hate him. It seems like, you know, in the press conferences, when he says, "I tell my players to play horny," you know, Mata's sitting there laughing, going, "Yeah, he does. It's hilarious." Like, we all laugh when he says it. Rooney and him, you know, they have pretty good, it seems like they have pretty good banter, and it's like mostly all smiles. They all, you know, it doesn't seem like it's a contentious relationship. I think the De Gea thing, if you were to point to something, probably goes back to early in the season when he benched him because De Gea wanted to leave the club. And I think there's probably something leftover, spillover effect from that. But I think on the whole, it doesn't seem like the young players dislike the manager. It doesn't seem like the senior players dislike the manager. It seems like Giggs and him actually have pretty good rapport. They are seen in discussions very regularly on the bench. So it doesn't seem like the environment is necessarily hostile or there's, you know, everyone's just talking behind Van Gaal's back that this guy's the worst guy in the world, we need to get rid of him. It seems like, okay, De Gea thing is probably the anomaly. So, you know, kind of given that, in taking that into account, it seems like that wouldn't be the reason why I would replace him. But yeah, I agree with you guys in the sense that I think Giggs is probably makes more of a sense where United is currently and where they kind of want to go, rather than, hey, we're getting all this new Premier League money, let's go spend it on a brand new squad. Jose, go buy whoever you want from all over Europe. And that just completely, what was the point of that transition from Moyes to Van Gaal? Nothing at that point, because it's genuinely you're going to go out and you're going to buy a brand new squad.
Guys, we got to wrap this up, but I will ask you one last question about these five cup finals on the weekend. If you had time just to watch one, which is the cup final you're going to watch?
I'm going to go with the DFB Pokal between Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, because I think probably it's the most evenly weighted of the finals.
I would go with Sevilla-Barcelona, mostly because I think PSG-Marseille would be very one-sided, and United-Palace has the highest chance of being unwatchable. I think even if Barcelona creams Sevilla, which I don't think they will, you're the most likely to see pretty soccer.
I agree with Alex on the DFB Pokal, and I also kind of agree with Leander, so watch both of those. But I also want to give honorable mention to the Coppa Italia, AC Milan versus Juve, because you guys refuse to mention.
I don't get Rye on my cable system, I don't think.
Well, stream it illegally or legally, wherever you can find it.
I don't get 2005 on my cable system.
Does the Italian league still exist?
No, it's just Juve just dominating teams. They actually, yeah, they crushed it. It's insane. But
everybody else is folded.
Yeah, something like that. But I will say, you know, the PSG-Marseille is probably Zlatan's last match for PSG. Not probably. It is Zlatan's last match for PSG. Yeah, so.
Before he joins LA Galaxy.
Well, we'll see where he joins. Zlatan will do what Zlatan wants to do. But that's probably worth watching that game just for that reason alone, or just tuning in for a little bit, because his post-match comments should be fun.
He'll probably start his own MLS team, the Zlatans.
I'm going to watch Man United Crystal Palace because I am a cord cutter and I can get that on free TV over the air. So it's time to go. Be sure to subscribe to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast on iTunes and check out all of our insights and opinions on the latest news in the soccer world and the FC Yahoo blog. For Shahan Ahmed, Alex Baker, and Leander Charlakins, I'm Joe Lago. You have been listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. So long. Bouncing so